please.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, I represent, my name is Patricia Hayes, and I represent the plaintiff, Dr. Renee Hildebrand, in a claim of gender discrimination against the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. This case comes to you after a jury trial in which a jury found a willful violation of the Equal Pay Act and awarded my client both damages and liquidated damages. We originally filed a Title VII claim, a 1983 claim against my client's supervisors, and also the Equal Pay Act claim. Dr. Hildebrand claims that the district court erred in granting summary judgment for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources on the Title VII claims, also that the defendant that trial court erred in granting summary judgment for defendants Little, Pequeno, and Cottrell on the 1983 claims. Plaintiff claims that there was sufficient evidence in the record in the manner in which that my client was evaluated and given pay raises to support an intentional discrimination claim against defendants Little, Pequeno, and Cottrell. In addition, we're claiming that the trial court erred in barring certain evidence from defendant's EEO officer concerning reports that she made after an investigation into the Unequal Pay Act claims. And lastly, we're claiming that the trial court erred in reducing the attorney fee award. Briefly, as to the Title VII claim, Dr. Hildebrand claims that she was paid less than comparable male employees due to the manner in which she was evaluated and continued to be evaluated from 1992 through 1999. She claims that she was given the lowest possible salary increase during each of those years up until the time of trial. Dr. Hildebrand started off in 1991 in her employment making the most out of any of the program administrators, and by the time of trial she was the lowest paid program administrator. Dr. Hildebrand obtained salary information concerning the salaries that she was earning compared to the other male program administrators in 1996 and began working through the internal grievance process through the Department of Natural Resources. She went to her supervisors, she went to Mr. Cottrell and asked for her salary to be evaluated and that her salary be given a salary increase. When that did not work, she went and filed an internal complaint with the EEO office, and the EEO officer, Teresa Cummins, did an investigation. That investigation and the results of that investigation were presented to the director of the Department of Natural Resources. And this, and in deposition, Teresa Cummins testified that her recommendations had the approval of the director. There was a meeting held on March 31st, 1998. That was the first time that Dr. Hildebrand learned that she had been given a lower salary increase in 1997. The court found that the claim was barred by the statute of limitations. It's our position that this is exactly the same type of continuing violation that the court addressed in Bazemore and in NutraSweet, where you have a continuing violation where your employer tells you, I'm going to violate your rights at least one time every year. This is the exact type of violation that has been addressed by this court.
Now, does NutraSweet survive the Supreme Court's decision in Morgan?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Does NutraSweet survive the Supreme Court's decision in Morgan?
I believe it does, Your Honor.
Why?
Because of the continuing nature of the violation and the fact that she continues, that the pay was in continuing violation.
Well, what can she recover for? Simply for the lack of the difference between what she should have gotten paid and what she did get paid after 1997? Or are you seeking payment retroactively to the time of the early, of the when she was paid at a discriminatory rate?
No, we're just seeking compensation from the date of 1997, from her date of charge.
Your point is that every paycheck she received after 1997 was at a discriminatory rate, and each paycheck, in effect, was a new discriminatory act. Am I right?
Well, it goes back with the willful violation under the Equal Pay Act, which we did prove she was entitled to go back for 3 years. But
as we're talking about the seven claim.
I'm sorry, yes.
When did you said in 1996 they discovered the discrepancies, right?
She found that she received some information from CMS. She got the, she did a Freedom of Information and found out that she was making less than the other male program administrators. She went to her supervisor and asked why, and he said, "Well, that was in the past. Let's just start with a new slate." And she said, "No, I want some compensation. I want my salary to be adjusted." And he refused to do so. So then she went and through the internal process
okay,
that...
I don't want you to have to repeat all that. What date did she file with the EEOC?
She filed within 60 days of March 31st, 1998. So in March 31st, 1998 was the date that she found out she had again been given a lower salary increase than the other male counterparts with the same evaluation. She had received an accomplished recommendation in 1997 like her other male counterparts, but she was given a lower salary increase.
So you have to have this continuing violation in order to have that, make that a timely filing under Title VII, right?
That's correct. But we do have a continuing violation.
Yeah, that's your argument, though. I just wanted to clarify that.
Exactly.
So with respect to her compensation, you prevailed on the Equal Pay Act claim.
Yes, we did.
You are now claiming error with respect to the Title VII claim with respect to the compensation.
Exactly.
What will you get if we were to reverse the district court of the Title VII, what additional remedy would be available to you?
Your Honor, we'd be entitled to compensatory damages in addition to back wages, and those compensatory damages would be up to $300,000. In addition, the damage,
What compensatory damages are you alleging occurred?
Emotional distress. We do have evidence of continuing psychological treatment with a psychologist during this period of time and medical damages. In addition, there are the costs. We were precluded from getting our expert witness fee costs based upon the Equal Pay Act, whereas those expert witness fees costs would be compensable under Title VII. So my client has out-of-pocket costs almost in the amount of $10,000 that were not awarded to her because of the difference in remedies available under the Equal Pay Act and Title VII and 1983.
Thank you.
We do have evidence of intentional discrimination by defendants Pequeno and Little. Those claims should not have been dismissed. Specifically, defendant Pequeno testified both in deposition and at trial that he was directly involved in the evaluation process and in the salary increases that were given to the program administrators. That was the reason that the district court dismissed Pequeno out at summary judgment. Therefore, that was clear error, and that should be reversed. Mr. Pequeno should be back in this case, as is Mr. Little.
Now, there was a little bit of a problem, according to the according to your adversaries, in finding exactly what evidence you rely on with respect to showing the involvement of these two people, Pequeno and Little.
At summary judgment, Your Honor?
How do we find it?
That I did point out in my reply brief that which is attached to the appendix, that there were admissions made by the defendant in their response to our statement of undisputed facts that Mr. Pequeno was directly involved in the evaluation process. In addition, I did move to supplement the record, and those depositions are now attached to the record. The deposition of Mr. Pequeno and Mr. Little are in the record. We're claiming that there wasn't, they are not entitled to qualified immunity. Clearly, the law in this circuit, as of 1997, was that salary could not be used as a means to effectuate gender discrimination. I mean, this court has recognized back as early as, well, back in 1997, that gender discrimination has been barred in the circuit for at least a decade and a half, and I presented the court with that, with those authorities. Therefore, the court, and in addition, the violation was so patent that anyone in this court or in that court would have known that if you use the compensation system to effectuate gender discrimination, you are violating the law. Gender discrimination has been a violation of the Constitution and Title VII since 1964. So there's no way that defendants Little or Pequeno could say they did not know that if they used the compensation system, even within the parameters of the guidelines, that they were, if they used it to effectuate gender discrimination, that they were violating the law. They are not entitled to qualified immunity.
Is this part of their equal protection claim?
Yes.
It is equal protection, not Title VII.
This is part of my equal protection claim. I'm sorry. Yes, we're claiming that defendants Little and Pequeno should not have been dismissed out at, well, Pequeno at summary judgment, and then Little at after in trial, based upon qualified immunity. Clearly, the law was clear that if you use that merit compensation system, regardless of whether it's within the parameters, if you're using it to effectuate gender discrimination, that was clearly a violation of the law in 1997. Any person would have known if they were intentionally using it to discriminate that that was a violation of the law. And we had plenty of evidence to prove intentional discrimination. Mr. Little specifically told the EEO officer, I will never give Renee Hildebrand more than an acceptable evaluation. That's clear evidence of intentional discrimination.
Is that all he said at that point?
That's what he said during...
That's all he said?
No, but...
what else did he say?
I don't know, Your Honor, but I believe that that was one of the things that he said during his interview of with Ms. Cummings.
Well, did he say something it's because she's a woman?
No.
Well, what is it? Maybe it's because he didn't think the quality of her work was up to par.
No. I mean, we did prove, I mean, that goes to pretext, and we did have sufficient evidence in the record to show that Dr. Hildebrand's performance was at all times impeccable. We had documentation after documentation, and the court did find, even in summary judgment, that there was sufficient evidence that her performance was not poor performance, that there were, she had awards after awards for her program in the urban forestry division. Therefore, I mean, that's sufficient evidence from which a jury could find that the reason that they gave the performance was mere pretext for unlawful sex discrimination. Lastly, I would like to address the attorney fee award. The court reduced the attorney fees by one-third, finding that this was just a minor civil rights violation. And that was clear error, and finding also that we were not successful on every count of our complaint. Well, we had common core of facts here. All the different counts related to the gender discrimination and the unequal wages. It was air for the district court to reduce the fees by one-third, finding that my client did not vindicate any other rights than herself. And I believe that this was addressed almost 30 years ago by the court when it found that unequal wages clearly was, if you vindicate those, you're doing it as a private attorney general. You're vindicating not only your rights, but the rights of all women. That cannot be any less important today, 30 years after the fact. And in the year 2002, women are still fighting for equal wages. So it was air for the district court to reduce the attorney's fees. And in the event that the court would continue to do that, you're going to foreclose attorneys from taking these type of cases. If their fees are going to be based upon a percentage of the success of a plaintiff. That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. I get out from Mr. Rossetti.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Rossett. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Illinois, and I represent the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and some of its employees in this appeal. Dr. Hildebrandt raises six issues in this appeal, and I'd like to touch on each one at least briefly. The first one is that the district court properly granted summary judgment to the individual defendants on Hildebrandt's Section 1983 claims related to treatment in the workplace other than compensation. The defendants invoked the affirmative defense of qualified immunity on these claims. And at that point, once they'd invoked that defense, it was Hildebrandt's burden to establish that there was clearly established law that she had a right to be treated identically to men in these areas of treatment in the workplace other than compensation. She failed to meet this burden. In her first memorandum in support of her opposition to our summary judgment motion, she cited absolutely no legal authority at all. So obviously she could not have clearly established that there was a constitutional right in this area. In her supplemental memorandum, she did cite two of this court's cases, but neither one was closely analogous to the claims that she was making. One was a prisoner case, which obviously has no relevance to an employment discrimination case. And the other involved sexual harassment and discharge, which are markedly different than the sort of things that she was complaining about here, which were such things as being given less support staff than male program administrators, and that her computer equipment was perhaps not as nice as the computer equipment that was being used by the men. Now, to this court, she cites two district court cases to try to show that the law was clearly established. But as this court has previously held, district court decisions are not precedent and cannot be used by themselves to establish that the law was clearly established at the time. Accordingly, we think that the district court properly granted us summary judgment.
Suppose we forgive counsel for lapses in legal research. What's the story on the merits of the qualified immunity claim?
Well, with qualified immunity, I think the analysis stops there. The law is clear under Rakovich and many other cases.
I understand.
Yes.
But I'm saying suppose we cut a little slack on that and we get to the merits of the qualified immunity thing. What's the story?
Well, then I would say that the law is not clearly established because as this court held in the McFaul case, which I believe Judge Mannion wrote a few years ago, not every negative employment action constitutes an adverse employment action for purposes of equal protection.
Then we would have to hold as a matter of law that this particular combination of deprivations amounts to is de minimis in effect, right, under McPhail.
No, I would say as you look at each one, I don't know, she's not really claiming a hostile work environment here. She's claiming that any time that an employer treats a woman different from a man on the basis of sex, no matter how trivial the matter is. Some of the complaints.
Suppose we cut a little slack there too and we say we're going to look at them all together. I mean, this was one employment relationship.
Right.
Let's look at them all together. Is that enough?
I don't think so because when we talk about adverse employment actions, we're talking about things that have real impact on the employee's life, such as promotion, discipline, discharge, things like this. And I think that the fact that perhaps secretaries as she said, made warm and fuzzy comments to the men and were cold to her, or the fact that she wasn't reimbursed for some mints that she brought to a conference, or even that she might not have had as nice computer equipment or as nice an office or things like that. Those, while they're potentially annoying or irritating to an employee, I don't think that they rise to the level of an adverse employment action and that they...
What would be a good criterion for us to use?
Well, I think that she would have to, there would have to be cases that, if not directly on point, at least talk about something in this area, about things...
What would be the principle you would expect to see articulated in those cases?
That it has to be something that directly affects the employee at a level that's significant enough to be a violation of the Constitution.
Makes it difficult to do her job?
Correct. For example, if she said that her performance suffered because of these things, then perhaps she might have a claim, but she's insisted...
Has McPhail been followed in other cases? Has that principle been articulated in other cases?
Well, McFall is a fairly recent case, so no, it hasn't been followed, but McFall did cite a Fifth Circuit case which held the same. So there is a consensus among at least two circuits that you need to have a significantly substantial adverse action. On the second issue, the district court also properly granted summary judgment to defendants Piquineau and Cottrell on this Hildebrandt Section 1983 claim regarding her 1997 pay raise because she did not demonstrate that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether they were personally involved in making that decision regarding her raise in that year.
Now, on her oral argument, your opponent mentioned that there are now depositions attached to the record that show that, in fact, they were involved.
Well, I think there's two problems with this being an evidentiary argument. The first is that in her opening brief, she provided no citations to the record at all in this argument to demonstrate that there was such evidence. So there are cases, including Vest, that say that when you have an evidence-based argument and you don't provide citations to the record, that you waive the argument. So our initial position is that argument is waived. Regarding the fact that she recently supplemented the record, those materials weren't in the record when she wrote her opening brief or when we filed our appellee's brief. So I have not had access to those materials. I was not able to discuss them, and I think it's too late for her to wait till about the time that she's
did
filing.
Did the court permit the supplementation of the record with those affidavits?
The district court did do so, and it ruled on it the day after the motion was filed. By the time I got the motion, it had already been granted, Your Honor. And perhaps the motion should have been granted because the district court clerk should have included those things in the first place. But it was her burden, when she was working on her opening brief, to notice that those important materials weren't in the record and to move to supplement at that time. Instead, her argument in her opening brief makes no reference to any evidence, much less this. And when I was preparing my brief, I only have the record on appeal to use. I can't talk about things that are outside the record. So,
suppose, though, we do look at these depositions. What's your reply?
Well, as I say, Your Honor, I haven't read them, so I don't know what they say. They weren't in the record when I wrote my brief. But our argument is that she has failed as an evidentiary matter by failing to point to these to anything in her opening brief and for failing to have these documents in the record at an appropriate time rather than just a month before argument and after both principal briefs had already been filed. The district court also properly granted summary judgment to the department on Hildebrandt's Title VII claims. The district court concluded that most of these claims were barred by the statute of limitations because they occurred more than 300 days before she filed her charge with the EEOC. And specifically regarding the compensation claims, the district court noted that July 10, 1997 was the cutoff date and that she had received the 97 raise before that date so that it wasn't properly within the statute of limitations. Now, as in her argument regarding the personal involvement of Piquineau and Cottrell, she attempts to rely on allegations and evidence that she provides no cites for in her opening brief, and we argue that, therefore, this argument is waived. But even if it's not waived, we think that the Descupta case is directly on point. In Descupta, we had the same sort of situation that we have here, where a plaintiff had received lower raises in years that were prior to the statute of limitations period, but during the statute of limitations period, she had received the same raises as other employees, which is what happened here. In 98, 99, and 2000, Hildebrandt received the same raises as the mail program administrators. her problem were in earlier years, especially in 92 and 93.
Her pay, her gross pay was still lower.
Right, because
we have still lower because, in her view at least, of earlier discrimination.
Correct.
So why isn't each paycheck she receives a new Title VII violation? Every paycheck you gave her after 97 is in fact lower than it should be because somebody discriminated against her.
Because she needed to challenge those earlier raises at the appropriate time, within 300 days of those raises. And that scooped up the situation was exactly the same. The individual claimed that in earlier years she had been discriminated against on the basis of his national origin and had received smaller raises, and he claimed, now I'm always behind because even though I'm getting the same raises currently as my colleagues, I can never catch up. Well, that's the same situation here. And this court said that this is not a proper application of the continuing violation theory to make this sort of an argument that the lingering effects of past discrimination are not currently actionable. You need to act at the appropriate time, and if you don't, you're basically out of luck. So we would ask this court to follow that SCUPTA, which specifically rejects those cases, Bazemore and NutraSuite, that Hildebrandt attempts to rely on at this point. The district court also properly granted judgment as a matter of law to defendant Little on Hildebrandt's Section 1983 claim regarding the 97 raise.
Now this was on a JMOL, am I right?
Correct. It was judgment as a matter of law at the close of the plaintiff's case. This is true because the plaintiff must prove discriminatory intent to prevail on an equal protection claim. And here she presented no evidence that the reason that Little gave her a smaller raise than the male program administrators in 97 was because of her sex. It's also questionable whether she was similarly situated to these male program administrators in that year.
Was that issue litigated at
which
trial? The similarly situated issue?
I don't believe so. Well, I mean, there was talk about, her claim is that because they all received the same overall evaluation of accomplished in 97, that therefore she should have been given the exact same raise. And to that extent, it was litigated. I mean, I think
the district court didn't rely on it, though. So am I correct? The district court relied on the intent issue?
The district court relied on two issues. First, it said that in the district court's opinion, Hildebrandt's own testimony showed that Little did not have the intent, mm-hmm. which in a way is the same as saying that she didn't prove the intent. And then the district court also found that Little was entitled to qualified immunity.
No, let's stop there for a minute. I have a little bit of a hard time appreciating the strength of that argument. After all, pretty clear you can't discriminate against somebody in the workplace on the basis of their gender.
That's correct. What I'm saying is she didn't show that Little here gave her a lower raise because of her sex.
That's intent. That's the intent issue.
Yeah. Right.
But on the qualified immunity issue.
On the qualified immunity issue, the court said that there was no closely analogous case or established case that said that giving a man and a woman who received the same overall evaluation for the year different raises was an equal protection violation.
A little analogy to Cinderella there. You know, the slipper's got to fit, but it doesn't have to fit like a glove, right?
Well, I think the problem is, Your Honor, there's only four categories that an employee can receive: unacceptable, acceptable, accomplished, or superior. So to say that three employees fit within accomplished doesn't mean that they have the exact same performance for that year and are entitled to the exact same raise. I give you an example in my brief about a grading system.
Yes, I read that.
And
I appreciate that, but I don't see how that helps you with the qualified. It helps you with the intent. It doesn't help. I have trouble seeing how it helps you with
Well,
the
it helps in that what the court was saying was there aren't cases out there that say that in this situation where people could be different and just happen to fall within the same category, that they're entitled to the exact same raise. I think if there was a scale from 1 to 100 and all three of these people got 85.6 and then there were different raises, that would be suspicious. But I think that just because they fall within these large categories doesn't guarantee. And if you look, one of the males got much less than another male. Hildebrandt got a 3.55% raise that year. Another male got a 4%, which is pretty close to the 3.55. And then another male got a 6%. So I think that defendant Little was looking at each employee's merit and deciding which one deserved the greater raise and which one deserved the lesser raise.
There's also the issue of job comparability, but we don't know what much to do with that because it apparently was litigated as a secondary argument at trial and the district court didn't rule on it.
I think we've admitted that their jobs were basically the same. Not their performance, but that their job duties.
I see.
There were four program administrators, yeah. And I think even in the answer to the complaint, we admitted that their duties were similar.
We really can't hang that on the district judge.
So really the raises each year were based on performance, and in the early years, 93 and 94, the defendant Little believed that Hildebrandt's performance was poor based on poor planning, inability to get along with support staff, things like that. So in those years, she got a smaller raise. One year she got no raise, one year she got a 2% raise, while the men's performance was good, so they got good raises. And then in later years, her performance improved, and she started getting comparable raises to the men, but she was never able to catch up, so that was the situation. So that's why she trailed. And counsel said earlier that she was the highest paid program administrator when she was hired. That's not true. She was the second highest paid. John Sester was the highest paid at the time and remained the highest paid all throughout. He had been a program administrator since the 1960s and had considerable seniority over Ms. Hildebrandt. Regarding the argument about the exclusion of Teresa Cummings' statements and her recommendations that the district court excluded from evidence, we think that this court need not reach this issue because Hildebrandt has not explained how she was harmed by the exclusion of this evidence. She won on the Equal Pay Act claim, and letting this stuff in would not have helped her. She couldn't win any more than she did win. And the statements were made and the documents were issued in March of 1998, so we don't think that they would have any relevance to the 97 pay raise, which was the only other issue that was involved in the trial. And further, she misleadingly asserts to this court that the documents were not admitted by the court, where in fact they were both read to the jury and they were admitted into evidence. And in her reply brief, she still insists that they were not, but frankly, I'm astounded by that. Finally, on the attorney's fees issue, the district court did not abuse its discretion in reducing her fees to reflect her limited success. The district court noted that she had recovered less than 1% of the amount that she sought. She had sought $6 million in her complaint, which she later escalated to $10 million, and she only received $50,000 ultimately as damages. The court also found that the claim was a basic Equal Pay Act case and that there were no significant legal issues. And in the Cook case, this court said that a run-of-the-mill employment discrimination case is an appropriate case to have the fees reduced. Further, the district court found that while Hildebrandt's personal rights were vindicated here, that the benefit to the public was not significant. And here, even with the one-third reduction that the district court imposed, the fees were still greater than the judgment. And if anything, we think that the district court was overly generous with the amount of fees.
Did she eyeball it?
Excuse me?
Did the district court just eyeball it, though? Is that a precise enough reduction to make it under our precedent?
Well, I think that the district court was intimately involved in this case, and it was a very long trial, and I think that she was in the best position. And I think, you know, you only find abuse of discretion when no reasonable person could have ruled it the way that the judge did, and I don't think that's the case here.
I understand that, but if you look at the case law and the attorney's fees, there's nothing more litigated more vociferously by lawyers and more precisely delineated by judges than attorney's fees, it seems.
Well,
I was wondering if we'll cut them by a third, cuts them.
Well, Hildebrandt didn't make that argument, so I didn't really research it or address it, Your Honor, but I think it was within the discretion of the court to reduce the fees here. Unless the court has further questions, we'd ask that you affirm on all six issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Court.
Ms. Hayes has 5 minutes left.
If I may briefly address the court's concern over the similarly situated comparable issue, the defendants in their answer did admit that Hildebrandt was comparable to the male program administrators and that the job duties were similar. Therefore, we've addressed that in for both Title VII and the 1983 actions. We believe that the court should view the sex discrimination under Title VII as a whole, as a totality of the circumstances. My client complaint that she made in her charge and also in her complaint was that she was denied adequate support staff, that she was denied adequate computer access, and that she was given unequal wages, and that those in the totality were all violations of Title VII, and those that she was denied those things based upon her sex in violation of Title VII. But those were the terms and conditions of employment that she was given unequal access to, and it made it very difficult for her to perform her job. And when performance is the issue that they are downgrading her on, they are, in essence, tying her hands behind her back because they were not giving her the staff in which to do her job duties. So we believe that those items, together with the unequal wages, do support a Title VII cause of action of sex discrimination. As to the direct involvement, again, I would like to point the court's attention to the statement of uncontested facts that the defendant admitted regarding Stuart Pequeno. He admitted in his statement of uncontested facts, they admitted that he was directly involved in both the evaluation process and in giving raises. That was on C-63, 69, 74, 96, 97, 104, and D-48. That was all in the appendix where he admitted the direct involvement. That was Stuart Pequeno. We didn't prove, because we don't have to prove at summary judgment stage. All we have to show is that there was sufficient evidence in the record from which a jury could find intentional discrimination on the part of Pequeno and Little and Cottrell. And I would like to point the court's attention to the fact that as of March 31st, 1998, all three of those persons were trying to verify their actions in this meeting that was held in John Camerio's office. They presented these salary schedules showing that my client, or Dr. Hildebrandt, had not been subjected to unequal wages or unequal wages or unequal raises over the past years. And as to the defendant's argument regarding the SCUTA, if I could address that issue. The SCUTA involved a situation where he had been subjected to unequal wages for a period of 4 years and brought the claim almost 10 years later, claiming that based upon those earlier salary increases that he was subjected to unequal wages. That is not what we have here. What we have here is as of 1997, the salary increase that is that question here was the July 1997 performance evaluation and salary increase, where once again Renee Hildebrandt was given the lowest possible salary increase that defendant Little could give her. That was the 3.5 salary increase. That was the lowest salary increase that he could give her based upon that accomplished evaluation. So we're claiming we're not upset with the accomplished evaluation. We're upset with the percentage increase that was given during that 1997. And after, the effects of that salary increase are the continuing violation. Each week that Renee Hildebrandt received that unequal wages based upon that evaluation in 1997 is a continuing violation, and it went up until the time she filed her charge of discrimination. That is the continuing violation that we are contesting, and that is not what Discuta says. This is Bazemore and NutraSweet. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.